Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel with the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I'm speaking with Victor McFarland, an assistant professor of history at the University of Missouri, about his stunning new book called Oil Powers, A History of the U.S.-Saudi Alliance. It was published this year by Columbia University Press. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States is important, odd, and as both regimes have tried to keep their citizens from knowing the extent of the relationship, challenging to study. But Victor McFarland does a fantastic job historicizing this alliance. He shows how it contributed to financialization, how it helped entrench a world order based on oil, and how it tugged both countries rightward from the 1970s on. Thanks for coming on the show, Victor.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Dexter. It's great to talk with you.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully from my little preamble, you can hear my excitement for this book.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm really happy that we're getting a chance to talk about an aspect of U.S. foreign relations, a really important alliance that we actually don't know that much about, surprisingly. And so just to begin, you know, we're going to be spending the hour trying to figure out the shape of this alliance, but I want to know how and why did you decide to do a project on the U.S.-Saudi alliance?
That's a good question. It started out with an interest in the Arabic language. As an undergrad, I started studying Arabic mainly because I thought the alphabet looked beautiful and I wanted to know how to write it. And at that point, I was studying American history. I was actually a 19th century Americanist and eventually wanted to find a way to combine those interests and to also combine my interest with contemporary world affairs and what was happening in the Middle East and with U.S. foreign policy. So I decided to work on the most recent topic in U.S. foreign relations with the Middle East, where the documents were reasonably open. And at that time, it was the 1970s. And as you mentioned, there was not a lot of great literature by historians about Saudi Arabia, with some exceptions, but most of the work was by political scientists and anthropologists and journalists. So there was an opening there to do a new project. And the more that I looked at U.S.-Saudi relations, the more fascinated I got in the topic. So it just went from there once I was in grad school.
Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that you could just give listeners a really quick summary of what the U.S.-Saudi relationship actually is and has been. So perhaps you can say a little bit about when the alliance began and how the two countries have benefited or at least thought they were benefiting from the alliance.
Sure. And first, I should say, even calling it an alliance is controversial. And there mm-hmm. are people who would object to that term. Very often, you hear it called a special relationship or a partnership. And that's the typical language that the U.S. and Saudi governments use. And it's reflected in a lot of literature on this topic. I'm relatively unusual in using the term alliance to describe what the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have. The case against using that term is that they've never signed a formal defense treaty. So the US has no relationship with Saudi Arabia equivalent to the one it has with its allies in NATO, for example. But I would argue by any common sense definition, the US and Saudi Arabia are clearly allies and have been at least since the 1970s. The United States arms the Saudi regime, arms the Saudi military, has come directly to the military aid of Saudi Arabia many times, but most notably during the Persian Gulf War in 1990 to 91. But there are a lot of smaller scale ways in which the US military has helped Saudi Arabia, most controversially over the last few years, by giving logistical support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, which has inflicted such a terrible toll on the Yemeni people. And so I don't think there's been any doubt in the eyes of most countries around the world or in US and Saudi policymakers' eyes since, at least since the Gulf War, and I would argue since the 1970s, that the United States has extended its military protection over Saudi Arabia. And by a common sense definition, that's an alliance. So in terms of when that began, the U.S.-Saudi relationship started with the very first diplomatic contacts in the 1920s and 1930s, just as the Saudi state was coalescing. And it picked up steam with the discovery of oil in Saudi Arabia by an American company in the late 1930s. But for a long time, Saudi Arabia was not a very high priority in the eyes of U.S. policymakers. In the 40s, 50s, 60s. And it wasn't until the oil crisis of the 1970s that Saudi Arabia really became a top American interest in the Middle East in the eyes of US policymakers. And the scale of the relationship just exploded. Huge arms sales, huge Saudi investments in the United States, much closer contacts between US and Saudi leaders at multiple different levels of their government. So I would say the alliance coalesced during the 1970s, and the foundation that was laid then is still very much in place today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this alliance is really like completely facilitated by oil. You know, the title of your book is Oil Power. And so you're looking at how the U.S. and Saudi Arabia their powers as states are really enabled by oil. Do you want to say something about this concept that you're working with, oil power?
Sure. So one of the things I'm doing with that phrase is to emphasize that the United States is an oil power too. I think Americans have a real tendency to other or exoticize petrostates and to think Saudi Arabia is in a totally different category from the United States, an abnormal category. It's not a normal state because it's dependent on oil. And there's no doubt that the Saudi regime depends for its revenue on oil sales and has for decades, and that its international influence is funded by oil, and that the Saudi regime has the support that it has from the United States in large part because of oil, either directly or indirectly. So it wouldn't be controversial to say Saudi Arabia is an oil power. I think it's important to remind people, though, that the United States has historically been an oil power too. The growth of American military power and economic power in the 20th century was facilitated by the fact that the United States was by far the world's biggest oil producer. That was clearest during World War II, when the United States literally fueled the entire Allied war effort and made more oil than all the other countries in the world combined.
Wow.
And that moment of the rise of the United States to superpower status, very directly fueled by American oil, stuck around in the U.S. national consciousness. And even after the United States became a net importer just a few years later in the late 40s, and then became more vulnerable to oil supply disruptions in the 70s. That was such a rude awakening and such a psychological shock to a lot of Americans, in part because they remembered the 1940s and they thought of oil as a vital ingredient in national power. And so to see American oil power threatened by the Arab oil embargo in 73 and by some of the other turmoil in the oil market in the 70s was such a shock to many Americans that they reacted by demanding a return to national energy independence, and failing that, a strong American military presence in the Middle East to retain some influence over the flow of that oil. And that's a big part of the story I tell about the U.S.-Saudi alliance during the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And why Saudi Arabia? There are tons of oil-producing countries around the world, but U.S. policymakers decided that it was Saudi Arabia that was going to be the most important one for strategic reasons. Can you say something a little bit about that?
Yeah, I find that question really interesting, in part because a lot of people don't think that that's really a question at all, that they would say, well, Saudi Arabia has the oil and the United States needs it. So obviously, Saudi Arabia is going to be important to the United States. I think a lot of both Americans and Saudis have some version of that story in their head. And it's one that's very much been encouraged by U.S. and Saudi policymakers. So in the book, in the introduction, I quote Prince Fahad, one of the top Saudi royals in the 1970s, saying, Saudi Arabia is the world's biggest oil producer, and the United States is the world's biggest oil consumer. And so it's only natural that we have this kind of relationship. And that was a very deliberate rhetorical move. I should say he was wrong. Saudi Arabia was not actually the world's biggest oil producer, just the biggest exporter. But even if Saudi Arabia had been the world's biggest oil producer, it wouldn't have made the U.S.-Saudi alliance inevitable. And people like Fahad and U.S. leaders talk as if it did, as if the alliance was inevitable because it got them off the hook for the political choices that they made. If you think about other countries that at different times have been bigger oil producers than Saudi Arabia, like Russia, for example, or the Soviet Union during the Cold War, or other big exporters like Iran, Venezuela, they have a lot of oil. Libya under Muammar al-Gaddafi, none of them had anything like the relationship that Saudi Arabia had with the United States. So just having a lot of oil or exporting a lot of oil didn't guarantee that alliance. It had a lot more to do with the fact that the United States looked at Saudi Arabia and saw a regime that they thought they could work, and a regime that was committed to a particular kind of relationship with the United States, and not just exporting oil, but using the revenue that it got from that oil to do things that the United States wanted, like buy U.S. weapons, like invest the surplus in the United States, like use that revenue to prop up anti-communist regimes and support anti-communist causes, like Mujahideen in Afghanistan would be the most famous example. So there was a lot more to that relationship than oil. And I'm not the first person to argue that. That's a theme in Rachel Bronson's book, Thicker Than Oil, for example, another book about the U.S.-Saudi relationship. But I try to unfold that in more detail than has been known before. And particularly on the U.S. side, there are more sources available now that let us tell that story in new ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's something that your book does extremely well. It shows that a lot of work had to go into this alliance, and all of that work suggests that it wasn't inevitable. Because had that work not been done, that, you know, like those like delegations and diplomatic initiatives and corporate initiatives and so on, without all that work, it's certainly possible that the U.S. would have allied more closely with another oil-producing regime.
Right. And it's important to point out, too, that for a long time, American officials were quite skeptical of the prospects for the Saudi regime. They weren't even sure that it would survive. For a long time in the 40s and 50s and 60s, it was very common to see U.S. officials predicting the Saudi regime would collapse in the fairly near future, particularly during the period of Gamal Abdel Nasser's leadership of the Arab nationalist movement in the 50s and 60s. A lot of U.S. policymakers thought that Egypt was was really the main player in Arab politics, and that Nasser represented the future of Arab politics. And Saudi Arabia was this strange, anachronistic, backward regime. And so it was not at all inevitable that the U.S. would place all its bets on Saudi Arabia and commit to that alliance. Even as late as the 70s, Iran was really the key U.S. security partner in the Persian Gulf, not Saudi Arabia. So a lot of things had to happen for the United States to make Saudi Arabia its key partner in that region the way it is today.
Mm-hmm. And another theme in the relationship and the alliance is this really odd relationship between domestic politics and foreign policy. I mean, you really show how they can diverge quite a bit. So, you know, both the Saudi government and the U.S. government wanted this alliance, but they also wanted to insulate their citizens from knowing about the alliance. This secrecy is what makes studying this alliance so difficult. But it's also, from the perspective of these policymakers, what even enables this alliance to persist. Can you explain why, maybe we can start with this, the Saudi government, why the Saudi government wanted to keep this secret?
Yeah, the Saudi government was always having to balance conflicting impulses in both their foreign policy and their domestic policy, and trying to please different audiences, or at least not aggravate different audiences too much. And that pulled them in different directions. So the Saudi government, from quite early on, from the 30s and 40s, from the very beginning of the modern Saudi state, was committed to a close commercial relationship with American oil companies, and later to a close security partnership with the U.S. Government. But for a variety of reasons, the Saudi alliance with the United States was quite unpopular with large segments of the Saudi public. The usual way that you would see that discussed in the United States is that the Saudi regime was torn between Westernization and traditional values, and that they had to placate a very conservative Islamic audience, Muslim audience at home, that didn't like an alliance with a non-Muslim power. And it's true that some segments of the Saudi opposition talked that way and framed their opposition in Islamic terms, in part because the Saudi government had so relentlessly made Islam the basis of their own legitimacy at home, that to counter those claims, the opposition had to make Islamic claims as well, religious claims. So also because the bits of the Saudi opposition that attained worldwide notoriety are folks like Osama bin Laden, who framed their critique of the Saudi state in those terms. But one of the things that folks who study Saudi Arabia have shown recently is that that there was a Saudi left going back to the mid-20th century, that there was a whole wide array of opposition groups, some of them very, very different from the hardline Salafi or Wahhabi Islamic conservatives, groups like Al-Qaeda, including Marxists and trade unionists, and probably most dangerous of all in the eyes of the Saudi regime were the left-leaning Arab nationalists in the 50s and 60s, inspired by people like Gamal Abdel Nasser. So that's a story where I engage with new work that people like Rosie Bashir and Bob Vitalis and others have written over the last decade or two. And those left-leaning parts of the Saudi public objected to the U.S., the alliance with the United States on anti-imperialist grounds, and based on the argument that the United States was trying to suppress left-leaning movements all over the world and allowing the Saudi government to establish an authoritarian right-wing system at home. And so for that reason, the Saudi government often worked pretty hard to shield the full extent of their alliance with the United States from the eyes of their own people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's in some of the chapters, it's really clear that public knowledge of the relationship would cause, huge problems. So for instance, during the 1967 war, you have a really interesting scene where King Faisal, he goes before a large crowd, which is something that he doesn't normally do, and basically decries Zionism. But then the crowd, goes even further and they start chanting, "Oil, oil, cut off oil from America, Britain and Israel. Faisal, cut off the oil." There is a really clear separation between sort of how these like elite policymakers are seeing the alliance and how everyday Saudi citizens are seeing the alliance.
Yeah, that was a fascinating scene to work on because it was reported one way in the Saudi press, where the official Saudi Gazette, Umm al-Qura, reported Faisal's speech. And it was a fairly brief story, but said Faisal denounced Israel. This was during the 1967 June war between Israel and its Arab neighbors, and didn't say anything about the crowd's reaction other than that they cheered Faisal and supported the Saudi regime's stance in the war. But the Saudi opposition literature described that scene in very different terms and described the crowd getting quite angry and Faisal retreating in panic, and his guards having to clear a path for him out of this. It was actually a horse racing arena, clear a path out of this facility for him to leave. And he got quite alarmed that the crowd was that agitated. And then if you look at the way that the essentially the intelligence department of Aramco, the American-owned oil company, reported that same scene, they corroborated what the Saudi opposition said, that things really got out of hand and the crowd went much further than what Faisal wanted them to do. And that's a good example of the Saudi regime trying to have this very careful balancing act where they criticize the United States, they criticize Israel, but they don't let it get too far. And sometimes they slip up and they lose control of the narrative. And that's what happened then. 1967.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to take that a little bit further, large political assemblies were not a thing that the government appreciated and permitted all that often. But then in this case, they let this happen, let people express themselves on the grounds of a facility that was built for the royal family, and so you can kind of see how the Saudi government is really trying to set the terms for politics.
Yeah, public space is rare in Saudi Arabia, both in the metaphorical sense that there isn't a free press and there's not much space for civil society, and then in a very literal physical sense that there just aren't big squares like Tahrir Square in Cairo or Martyrs Square in Beirut, the kind of places that you associate with big demonstrations and political gatherings and that have enabled popular mobilization in Egypt and Lebanon. In Saudi Arabia, I think quite deliberately, those spaces just don't really exist. And so there's private space or homes and businesses, and there's religious space. There's the mosque. But the government is very reluctant to allow any kind of secular space for civil society. And I think in that scene in 1967, you see what they were afraid of, that if you just let people gather in one place and let them say anything politically, even if it's a demonstration sponsored by the regime, things can get out of hand pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to kind of stay on this, in this moment, during this war, the Saudi government was, publicly lambasting, Israel and Zionism and committing troops and so on. But in actuality, do you want to just say like what they were actually doing?
Right. So they said that they were sending troops to the fight. In reality, they slow walked it, and they sent only a small group of soldiers and made sure that they wouldn't arrive until the fighting was over. And then that Saudi military unit was stationed near the borders with Israel for the next several years. And the CIA speculated that one reason why that happened was not actually to pose any kind of threat to Israel. It's pretty clear that the Saudi regime did not want to get in a real war with Israel, but that perhaps those soldiers were stationed outside Saudi borders just to keep them out of the country so they could launch a coup. The Saudi government constantly worried about the reliability of its own armed forces for very understandable reasons, that Arab regimes fell much more often to a coup from their own military than they did to foreign invasion. And the Saudi government had a lot of examples that they could think of from the coups in Egypt that brought Gamal Abdel Nasser to power, to Iraq, the toppling of the Iraqi monarchy, to the toppling of the Libyan monarchy. They didn't want that to happen. And so they deliberately kept their military quite weak and divided. And it was not in any condition to fight Israel or any other militarily competent adversary. And the Saudi government knew that.
Great. And so far you've really illuminated why the Saudis might want to keep this relationship secret, but so too did the United States. And I was just wondering if you could share a little bit about why U.S. policymakers, why the State Department and the White House didn't want its citizens to know about this relationship.
One of the things I was really surprised to learn when I started researching this story was how far back the domestic opposition went in the United States to the U.S.-Saudi alliance. It's something that we're familiar with today, that there's quite a bit of congressional criticism of, for example, Donald Trump's support of the Saudi regime and U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia. And what I was really fascinated to see was that there was opposition in pretty similar terms in the U.S. Congress and among other political actors in the United States all the way back to the 1940s, to just about the beginning of any relationship at all between the Saudi government and the U.S. government. That opposition was often framed around Zionism. So the most vocal opponents of the U.S.-Saudi alliance tended to be supporters of Jewish settlement in Palestine and then supporters of the Israeli state. But those critiques of the U.S.-Saudi alliance and of the United States for partnering with a regime that was quite blatantly anti-Semitic, in addition to being very strongly anti-Zionist, those critiques were often linked to much broader concerns about the growth of presidential power and the tight connection between corporate power and government authority. So, for example, there's this famous meeting between FDR and Abdulaziz, or Ibn Saud, the first king of modern Saudi Arabia, February 1945. And I found that that there was quite a bit of criticism of that meeting, including from the U.S. Congress, and arguments that FDR had made some kind of secret deal with Ibn Saud, possibly to sell out Israel. And it's no accident that those critiques were emerging in the 1940s, right at the end of the war, this period of massive growth of U.S. Government power, and especially the power of the national security state, and the commitment to a particular kind of aggressive internationalism and assertion of U.S. power abroad. The kind of story that Stephen Wertheim is telling in his new book that will be out soon. And one of the ways to critique that kind of unaccountable power of the executive branch was to point to this emerging relationship with Saudi Arabia, which was negotiated and managed almost entirely by the executive branch, very little congressional involvement, and often kept secret from Congress. And that secrecy was designed to sideline this opposition. But it became a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy where the more secretive the alliance was, the more it was shielded from public view, the more mm-hmm. suspicious it looked in the eyes of its critics. And that really set a pattern that continues to this day.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you had to deal with all this secrecy as a scholar. And so I would love to hear about what the research experience was like, trying to figure out what happened when, on the one hand, both sides tried to keep the relationship secret. And then on the other hand, Saudi Arabia is not known for, liberal access to its, state records.
To say the least.
Yeah. And so I what did you encounter when you were researching this book?
So Saudi Arabia is a very difficult place to do research. And I knew that going in. It was very difficult even for me to get a visa to come to Saudi Arabia. It took about 11 months of applying and pestering people. And eventually it happened because I was at a conference at Princeton University and a senior Saudi royal, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, was there. And I got to talk to him briefly and talk to some of the folks who were there with him. And the visa was delivered very shortly after that. And I got to be based at the King Faisal Center for Research in Islamic Studies, which Prince Turki helped run. And named after King Faisal, the king during the 1960s and the first half of the 70s, the king during the time of the oil crisis. So I got office space, I got letters of introduction. And even that, of course, only got me so far. There really aren't government archives that are open to researchers, either Saudi or foreign. So I ended up working a lot with published records. I read through all the Saudi newspapers that I could find, all the published speeches. I got interviews with some former policymakers, Saudi leaders from that era, including Prince Turki. But even the published sources, although they came from a press that was heavily censored, and they didn't reveal internal debates within the Saudi government, I thought they were still quite fascinating because they revealed the way that the Saudi regime wanted itself to be seen in the eyes of an Arabic-speaking audience, both a domestic Saudi audience, but also elsewhere in the Arab world. And sometimes that was similar to the story that they were telling U.S. officials behind closed doors in English. And sometimes it was entirely different. And so to be able to triangulate between those and look at the official Saudi narrative and then look at what was going on behind the scenes, I think revealed new dimensions of this alliance. And if you like, I can talk a bit about the challenges on the U.S. side too, which are
I think conversations about how scholars did their research are really valuable. So please go ahead.
Well, on the American side, in some ways, it's the opposite problem in that the volume of sources is so huge. Anyone who works on U.S. foreign relations, I know you know this, Dexter, that if you go to RG59 in College Park, you can very quickly just get overwhelmed if you're not doing something very narrow, if you're not working on 1 or 2 years, the volume of sources become unmanageable. So that's always a challenge, figuring out how to find the narrative thread through this massive sources. But also, even though I was working on documents that were somewhere between 40 and 50 years old, for the most part, I still had trouble getting access to some US sources. Almost anything related to the details of military or intelligence policy was still classified. Even a lot of the State Department stuff was heavily redacted. And one of the really challenging things about studying the US-Saudi alliance, especially in the 70s, was that important parts of that relationship were conducted outside the normal diplomatic channels. And in Saudi Arabia, arguably the CIA station chief, Riyadh, was more powerful than the ambassador. Or at the very least, a lot of what would be normally conducted through the embassy in another country went through the CIA in Saudi Arabia. There were back channels that circumvented the State Department, and a lot of the really sensitive stuff went that way, and a lot of that is still not available. Some of it, fortunately, has been declassified thanks to the efforts of the State Department's Office of the Historian through their first volumes. Quite a bit is still locked down. So doing this project meant filing FOIA and mandatory review requests to look at what I could, but also a lot of reading between the lines. And in some cases, I had to resort to a bit of guesswork and try to figure out, patch together what information I could from interviewing people and from what you could tell from the documents and get some sense of what was passing through those secret back channels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really fascinating. Thankfully for me as a dissertator right now, the problem of too many sources has been dealt with by the pandemic. And so,
there's now a silver lining, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So let's move on to the 1970s, which is really the climax of the book, at least as I see it. And so one of the the key moments is the oil embargo of 73-74. And this is a really interesting moment because Saudi Arabia, it aimed its oil power weapon at the world, at the United States. And this is like in the context of the two countries still having an alliance. And so I was hoping that you could briefly explain what the embargo was, why it happened, and then we'll perhaps talk about some of the consequences.
Yeah, that's a complicated question because the embargo has come to be an umbrella term for a lot of things that happened in late 1973 that weren't all necessarily part of the embargo itself. So in October 1973, the Arab oil-producing countries declared separate embargoes on the United States. It was not actually a collective decision. It happened one by one. So Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, the other big oil producers, at different points during the October 1973 war, they all individually declared oil embargoes against the United States and then agreed to maintain the embargo until Israel withdrew from the Arab territories that it had occupied in 1967. At the same time, they also, some of them at least, cut production, and Saudi Arabia was the biggest exporter, so its production cuts were the most important. That was a very blunt instrument where, unlike the embargo, it wasn't targeted at the United States specifically. Production cuts sent oil prices up everywhere in the world. And this all happened against the backdrop of what people were already calling the energy crisis. There was already turmoil in the world oil market. This was right at the moment when the big Anglo-American oil companies, like what are today ExxonMobil or BP or Shell, they were losing control over the big oil fields in the Middle East as those were getting nationalized. So there were some long-term changes that were happening that were exacerbated by some short-term developments during the October 1973 war. And all of this combined to send oil prices skyrocketing. And it so happened that the United States had a very cumbersome system of domestic price controls that didn't react well to this supply shortage or price increase. increase. And the result was the long lines at gasoline stations and skyrocket prices in the United States that people remember from 1973 and 1974. The embargo itself was actually not very effective. It was fairly easy for the oil companies to circumvent it. And Saudi Arabia didn't even fully abide by their own embargo. They secretly continued shipping oil to the U.S. military, which was the only actor in the United States that really depended heavily on Persian Gulf oil. For the most part, the oil that Americans consumed came from places other than the Gulf. So Saudi Arabia softened their own embargo secretly, of course, and they kept that secret even from most of the Saudi government. They continued to ship oil to the U.S. military. But even though the embargo itself is not all that effective, it came to stand in for this whole set of bigger changes in the world oil market that meant much higher prices and a lot more uncertainty about oil supplies for consumers in the United States. And that was quite a rude awakening for a lot of Americans who were accustomed to oil prices being pretty steady. They had been very steady for the previous quarter century and not having to worry much about the availability of oil.
Yeah, I think this is a really discombobulating moment for Americans for all the reasons that you stated. It's like, you know, they're increasingly dependent on oil imports. There's this energy crisis that everyone is worried about. And also, at the exact same time, the oil producing states in the Middle East are accumulating vast reserves of cash. And so there's this real shift in power, or at least so it seems. All these things play out in the 1970s. And I guess, yeah, like maybe a good place to start is money. Saudi Arabia and other oil producing states got really wealthy really quickly. And it became a really, big and political question, what to do with all that cash. You provide a history of something that I actually didn't know anything about, but was really flabbergasted by. The JECOR. I don't know if you'd call that JCOR or...
Yeah, I think of it as JCOR. I'm not actually sure if that's an official pronunciation or not.
Okay. For the purposes of this conversation, we will refer to it as JCOR. And you'll have to explain the abbreviation or the acronym. It's essentially this U.S. Institution that is designed to get Saudi Arabia to buy as much crap from the U.S. as possible. And like in many cases, it just turned out to be institutionalized grift. So I would love for you to just maybe elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah. So JCOR was the U.S.-Saudi Arabian Joint Commission for Economic Cooperation, which was a joint body negotiated by Henry Kissinger and Prince Fahad and people working for them. In the immediate aftermath of the 1973 to 74 embargo, this was supposed to be part of the deal that would put the U.S.-Saudi alliance back on track after the embargo. And it was officially a way for the United States to help guide Saudi economic development and provide Saudi Arabia with technical expertise and the goods to let Saudi Arabia convert its oil revenues into a more sustainable base for economic growth in the future that wouldn't be so totally dependent on oil. In practice, you're absolutely right that it was frequently just a means for channeling Saudi oil revenues into the pockets of American corporations and part of a broader pattern of Saudi spending expanding so dramatically in the 1970s that it attracted what one U.S. diplomat called vultures from all over the world, but a lot of American vultures of folks trying to get in on this gold rush and trying to sell whatever they could to Saudi Arabia. And in some cases, you called it crap. And I think that's a that's a accurate description. There is one interview with a former U.S. diplomat that I ran across where he talked about part of his job as an economic officer with the State Department was selling this stuff to Saudi buyers that included things like raincoats, which were totally unnecessary in that climate. They were not suitable for Saudi Arabia, and they hastily rebranded them as tarps that you could use for camp, tarps for Bedouin, and somehow unloaded them on a Saudi buyer. So a lot of what JCOR did was help channel some of these revenues. And even some of the folks who worked for JCOR, some of the American bureaucrats, became kind of disgusted with what they were doing and wrote an expose or two about how it was really a means for enriching American companies. They did things like they were providing technical expertise to Saudi Arabia, which included setting a lot of different standards, technical standards. This might overlap a bit or connect with the story that that Daniel Immerwahr tells in his new book, The Importance of Technical Standards. And so they would say things like, well, your electrical grid has to operate at such and such a voltage, and your appliances have to work with the grid in such and such a way. And when there were competing standards, American or European or Japanese, JCOR would almost invariably recommend the American standards, which meant that business had to go to American companies. And this was a easy way for the United States to try to get some of those dollars back that were flowing out of the country to pay for imported oil. And of course, a lot of people in the Saudi government were quite aware of what was happening. And sometimes it was excused as a way to strengthen the U.S.-Saudi relationship that was needed for security reasons. But sometimes Saudi officials, too, were really quite disappointed in JCOR, and it never fulfilled the hopes of the people who had designed it originally. It never reached the scale that they hoped. But it did help solidify that alliance during that critical period, the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other aspect of the vast monetary resources of Saudi Arabia in this time period were all the investments that they made in the United States and in U.S. companies and banks and, U.S. treasuries. And I was really surprised in this section of your book by just how public this debate was. So you have U.S. policymakers and, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve and the State Department trying to, attract Saudi investment into the United States. But then on the other hand, you have, congressmen and other people who are really critical of and nervous of how much Saudi Arabia is investing in the U.S. Because they see this as sort of the of Saudi Arabia basically, like buying power within the United States. Can you share this really fascinating story?
So it was operating on a couple of levels. In some ways, that phenomenon was kept very, very secret. The details of Saudi investment in the United States were one of the most closely guarded secrets in the American government. And in some cases, the Treasury Department and other branches of the U.S. government that were working with the Saudi Central Bank, SAMA, to attract this money had to reprimand the CIA for releasing too much information to Congress and the public. So when the CIA is getting chided for being too too open, something is weird. Something's off with this picture. And so I cite a few examples of it's almost comical to look at some of these documents that I have one as an image in the book where they're talking about Saudi investment in the United States. This included Saudi investment in U.S. Treasury bonds, also in the mortgage market. So this is an early example of financialization of American mortgages, that the U.S. government was working very hard to attract Saudi funding to Freddie Mae and or Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to prop up the U.S. or attract funds to the U.S. housing market. They released these documents to Congress and redacted parts of the document where they talked about where the money was coming from. And it's very obvious. You can just count the letters and you can see where they're saying the Saudis or Saudi Arabia, but it all had to be removed. So the details they try to keep secret, but you're right that the fact that huge Saudi investments were flowing into the United States was not something that kept secret. It was the subject of a lot of debate in Congress and the U.S. press. It was part of pop culture at the time. So if you know the movie Network, the deranged newscaster's rant, that's the most quoted part of that movie, the I'm mad as hell rant, was about Arab investment in the United States and the Saudis buying up American companies. And so you see this interesting debate between, on the one hand, critics of the U.S.-Saudi alliance saying the Saudi regime just carried out an oil embargo against us and they're anti-Israel. And this was often wrapped up with a certain amount of Islamophobia and Orientalist stereotyping about the Arab world. So people saying for various reasons, we don't want their money and we don't want those people. We don't want the Saudis buying up American businesses. And on the other hand, the U.S. government trying very, very hard to attract that money, at least the executive branch. Sometimes that effort being defended in terms that would be very familiar to anyone who's familiar with the Washington consensus or what's happened in the world economy since the end of the 20th century. Well, we have to compete, and there's a world marketplace for capital. And if the Arab oil exporters are the ones that have capital, then we can't let Europe or Japan get that money. We've got to give them attractive terms in the United States. And if that means offering them secrecy, and if it means deregulation and exempting them from certain rules, well, that's a reasonable price to pay for economic competitiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get into it too much just because we are running out of time, but you actually have some evidence that of the Treasury's understanding of these investments as kind of almost like insurance against future embargoes, because Saudi Arabia invests more and more into the United States, it basically binds these an oil producing state with an oil consuming state, and so it's this like geopolitical maneuver that the Treasury was aiming at. But I'll have to just let the readers look at that in the book. Just to move on a little bit, something that I was also really surprised by and interested in was your argument that the alliance and the influence of Saudi Arabia actually helped pull U.S. foreign policy rightward and into more interventionist territory. Can you share with listeners what you mean by that and sort of why you're saying that?
Saudi Arabia constantly encouraged the United States to be more aggressive in the Middle East behind the scenes. In public, they were saying something very different. But in private, Saudi officials constantly urged the United States to do more to fight communism in the region and to give more aid to anti-communist causes. And that became a fairly potent argument during the 1970s in the hands of hawkish forces in the U.S. government, who probably wanted those same policies for other reasons. But once Saudi Arabia became such an important oil supplier and supplier of investment capital to the United States, and a more important player in regional politics, distributing aid to Jordan, Egypt, and a lot of other countries that the United States wanted to support too, the argument that we have to maintain Saudi goodwill became, I think, a pretty potent argument in intergovernmental debates in the United States. So probably the biggest example would be during the Carter administration, that this was an argument that his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, deployed to say, well, we have to act aggressively in Afghanistan. We have to act aggressively in the Horn of Africa and so forth, because if we don't, the Saudis will lose confidence. Now, Brzezinski probably had his own reasons for wanting all of those policies, but But Saudi Arabia was a very excuse for him. And he made that argument publicly, the famous Arc of Crisis argument that the United States needed to get more involved in the region. So that was one example. In other cases, it was even more obvious that under Carter, for example, at one point, the United States rushes the shipment of military aid to North Yemen, even though almost all of the U.S. experts on the ground thought that North Yemen didn't need that aid. They were involved in what turned out to be a very minor border clash with the Marxist regime in South Yemen. But the United States did it anyways because Saudi Arabia paid for the whole package and demanded it. They were worried about Marxist forces on their southern border. And so I think that was a case where it's fairly clear the United States undertook this intervention and got involved in a conflict it wouldn't have otherwise gotten involved in, almost solely to maintain Saudi goodwill. That's how important Saudi preferences were to U.S. foreign policy at that point. And then there are some other cases where Saudi resources just enabled the U.S. Executive branch to do things it couldn't have otherwise done. Saudi Arabia was an alternative revenue source for foreign adventures that you didn't have to go to Congress to get support for. And the famous example would be Afghanistan in the late 70s and the 80s. Saudi Arabia subsidized aid to the Mujahideen there. But there are other examples, some of which we know about, some of which we only have hints of U.S. Adventurism in the Middle East, and in some cases beyond, that was subsidized by Saudi Arabia in a way that then shielded it from public view and congressional authority mm-hmm. in the United States.
Yeah, no, I think that's super fascinating, and it shows how U.S. policymakers saw Saudi Arabia as extremely useful in kind of like a post-Vietnam War congressional environment where there are a lot more restrictions on the executive branch and intervention.
That's right. Although I don't think we can let Congress entirely off the hook here. And one of the things I was most surprised by and sort of appalled by was to see how much congressional sentiment by the late 70s shifted in favor of very hawkish right-wing stance in the Middle East, because Saudi oil was thought at that point to be so vital to the United States that if the Soviet Union posed a threat to it by invading Afghanistan or getting more involved in the region, which and we now know those threats were greatly exaggerated. But at the time, if that's how it looked, that the Soviet Union might be able to cut off the flow of oil to American allies or the United States itself, then the U.S. had to get involved. And I was really surprised to see at the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s, even George McGovern was actually saying, if the Saudi regime looked like it should fall, the United States should send in the Marines and protect the Saudi government from their own people, from a domestic revolution.
Wow. Which,
for George McGovern to say that just a few years after Vietnam, it showed how much the debate had shifted by the end of the 70s and showed how much the ground was prepared for Reaganism even before Reagan himself became president.
Yeah, that's a really revealing quote. Oh my gosh. Yeah, we will not let Congress off the hook. and so just getting to the end of your book, you write something that I thought, again, was really, really interesting and provocative. And that's over time, Saudi Arabia became more like the United States, but the United States also became a bit more like Saudi Arabia. Can you share with listeners what you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a good question. In part, what I'm trying to do is push back against the typical U.S. belief that the United States can change other countries and isn't changed by them in return. So you see a lot of examples in the story I tell in the book of U.S. officials thinking they could reform Saudi Arabia or they could put pressure on Saudi Arabia to do this or that, or over time, Saudi Arabia would naturally come to look more like the United States. And it's true that in the story I tell, there are a lot of examples of Saudi Arabia adopting certain American-style institutions or being influenced by the United States in different ways. But I also think that the United States was changed by this relationship. And one of the examples which we were just talking about, is that the United States adopted a more hawkish stance in the Middle East and got entangled in the Middle East, deployed thousands of troops and paved the way for what would happen in 1990 to 91 with the Gulf War and then with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11 and the continuing so-called global war on terror, that was partly in response to Saudi preferences, that Saudi Arabia wanted more U.S. military involvement in the region to protect the Saudi regime, even though publicly they would almost always deny that. So they influenced American foreign policy in ways that we're still paying the cost for, very serious costs. But Saudi Arabia and the U.S.-Saudi alliance also resulted in some changes domestically in the United States. They expanded the power of the executive branch. They provided some new arguments for people who wanted deregulation and who wanted to accelerate the financialization of the U.S. economy. And the availability of these billions of dollars of Saudi investments was a very attractive prize to some of those folks who wanted to push the U.S. economy rightward in the 70s and 80s and have a particular kind of deregulation. And new secrecy around U.S. foreign policy, around international economic relations, that was something that Saudi Arabia pushed for. Now, I don't think that you can blame any of these big shifts, financialization and more market-oriented economics and a assertive U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. You can't blame any of that exclusively or even primarily on Saudi influence, but Saudi Arabia contributed to it in alliance with U.S. policymakers and elites who wanted those same things for their own reasons. So after now more than a half a century of close relations between the Saudi regime and the U.S. government, Saudi Arabia looks different than it did before, but so does the United States.
Mm-hmm. Great. I think that's a really good place to leave the discussion about the book. And as we always do on the New Books Network, we ask what you're working on right now.
I'm doing a bit of a change of pace right now. I'm working on a small project that might be a article or two, or it might be a short book about a very strange project by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission during the period of the oil crisis at the beginning of the 70s to frack for natural gas, but not using pressurized water and fluids, but rather doing it with nuclear explosives. And they did this three times with live tests. They planned to do it 30,000 times if they got their way to deploy this on a very big scale across the gas and oil bearing regions of the American West. And for very good reasons, those plans were abandoned. So I'm interested in telling that story.
Wow. That sounds like a super fascinating project. I'll look forward to reading it. I want to thank you again, Victor, for taking the time to speak with me.
Yeah, thank you, Dexter. It's been a pleasure talking.
Yeah, and you've been listening to New Books in History, and we've been speaking with Victor McFarland about his new book, Oil Powers, A History of the U.S.-Saudi Alliance.